X is for Podcast Mutants, Magic, and Marvels is brought to you by the Cage Club Network. So for all things media, check out cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. And for all things X is for Podcast, check out X is for Podcast on Twitter and YouTube.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another all-new X's for Podcast, the show where we take a look at comics, mutants, magic, and marvels week after week through their many monthly titles. I'm Nico, and you guys can check me out on Twitter and Instagram at NicoAction. That's NicoAction. Today we're going to be coming to the magic side of things, taking a look at two sorts of different camps of Marvel magic. We're going to be taking a look at Strange Academy, as well as a number of the stories from the recent Marvel Voices Comunidad's one-shot, featuring Strange Academy and Strange Academy-adjacent characters, as well as a trio of titles from the Darkhold event. So kicking things off is Strange Academy 13 and 14, as well as the community stories, and I just feel like Strange Academy is the book that maybe most captured our hearts here on X's for Podcast. I believe it's the book that's had the most number of different contributors covering it at this point, and it just really speaks to what we all love about Marvel Comics and the Marvel Magic world. We hope you guys enjoy just as much as we enjoyed making it, and if you guys like what you hear, you might even like what you see. So don't forget to give us a subscribe over on Twitter at X is for Podcast. Hey everybody, welcome back to X's for Podcast, the show where we take a look at comics, mutants, magic, and marvels week after week through their many academically-minded titles. I'm Nico, and you guys can check me out on Twitter and Instagram at NicoAction. That's NicoAction. Now you, Steven.
I'm so sorry. I'm Steven. You could find me on Twitter at Steven of Wonder, and also on Facebook in the House of Northstar group.
I'm Kyle. You can find me on both Twitter and Instagram at Drantis82. That's DRANTIS82.
I'm TK. You can find me on Twitter at XNateXGrayX.
And I'm Dame Red Bento, aka Raven. So come over and find me on like Twitter, TikTok, or Instagram, or whatever. Just start a conversation with me. Trust me, got tons to say.
Okay, so we had so many tons to say. We actually tried covering this issue a fucking month ago, but I'm a disaster piece.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm always looking for a museum to hang in. So we are here today to discuss Strange Academy 13 and 14, as always, by series creators Scotty Young, Humberto Ramos, Edgar Delgado, and VCs Clayton Cowles, who comes in and puts in the incredible, unforgettable, one-of-a-kind letters on this book. And if you want any proof that VC's Clayton Cowles carries this book as far as he can as a letterer, just remember that that first page of 13, all of the school presentation sign-up sheet, all of that font work is this one person making sure every character comes across through font, right? You know, this show is one of the few shows that goes out of our way to stan letterers. We are an open door policy for Ariana Maher, and we just did that incredible interview with her for the Hellions retrospective. And I don't mean to be weird, but you know, letterers don't get anywhere near enough credit. Additionally, we're going to be taking a look at a short handful of stories from the most recent Marvel Voices issue. Now, these stories tie into Strange Academy. So we're also going to be taking a look at Just As Strange As You by Terry Blas and Julius Ota, with art by Eric Arseniega. Now, I want to point out that this story was vaguely hinted at on our show a number of months ago. Terry had said that he had hoped that Eva would be able to get her magic books from Strange Academy. And so here we are several months later in that position. We also had a number of other stories in this, such as Mom's Cooking, which is by Edgar Delgado and Francisco Herrera, as well as Fate and the Sorcerer Supreme, which, Raven, every page of that, all I could think of was about you and how happy that story must have made you.
Oh my God. All three of those stories made me so deliriously happy. I was so happy to see those, and they did such a good job with those characters and with the stories. Oh, I loved it. it. I loved every last panel of it.
Well, and I cannot wait to talk about those stories with you. That Nina story was done by Juan Ponce and Wilton Santos with Sean Parsons, as well as Dijo Lima. Now, once again, I gotta say, book was lettered by Ariana, not to be that guy, but it was. And that is because she is a proud Latina who really wanted to be a part of this title. And so she was so excited to get to see so much Brazilian representation as a Brazilian woman. It was just really cool to get to hear my friend be proud of her work. You know what I mean? Like, I loved this whole process of seeing Strange Academy pop up other places, but okay, I'm talking too much. So Raven is the, you know, headmistress of Strange Academy here on this show. Kyle has been an associate professor coming and going as his, will takes him. But TK, Steven, this is your guys' first appearances here covering Strack with us. So my question for you is, what kind of Strack boys are you? Are you guys like longtime students? Are you guys, you know, the bad boys? You guys making out together under the bleachers? What's going on?
That last one.
Hot.
That's a lot of chest hair between the two of you is all I'm
saying. It's like Velcro.
I am a new enrollee into the Strange Academy. I did come just for the cute boys. When we were talking about this issue being discussed, I thought of it as a really good excuse to catch up on everything because I'd read the first issue, but I really had always been like, I need to read this, and kept putting it off. And I thought this is the perfect opportunity to do it. So I've been reading everything over the past 4 or 5 days, and I'm so in love with it. I can't even begin to tell you.
That makes me so happy.
Yeah, I actually was so excited when I first heard about the book, and then I was able to read the first 3 issues, and then I kind of fell off, not because I didn't like it, because I actually loved it. And then today was like a really, really good reason for me to actually catch up. It breezed by. Like, it was so wonderful to just read, and I'm just so enamored with the book.
Famously read the first issue, walked away really quickly because I just felt like I didn't have room for another book. And then my single best friend in the entire world over there, Kyle, was like, I think it was issue 3 or 4, was like, are you still reading Strange Academy? And I was like, no, I'll catch up at some point. Why, bro? Why? And he's like, because Dead Girl's in the fucking book. And I was like, I have to buy every issue. Yeah, I gotta go. I can't keep talking to you.
My immediate thought. The moment I saw her, I was like, oh, that's why we're doing this.
Yeah, kind of sorta got added to our rotation the next month, and
we've never heard
back. So Kyle, Raven, both of you have been denizens here in the hallowed halls of Strange U since we started covering it. And in that last segment, we had a lot of opportunities to talk about the real magic of this book and what we were hoping for from the future of it. And you've both already gotten things you wanted from issue 14 that weren't in issue 13. So my question for you guys is a little bit different. If you guys went to Strange Academy, what would be your dream Strange Academy role? Professor? Student? Would you guys want to be like a visiting adjunct? How would you guys, having had, at this point, 15 and a half issues, it's 14 plus, the Death of Doctor Strange one shot that we can all agree is, say it with me, an annual, right? And then the Marvel, I swear to God, I went hoarse screaming that. And then the Marvel Voices stories. So we have like 15 and a half issues. Guys, what would be your dream Strange Academy position?
Oh God. Like off the top of my head, I would want to be a chaperone and be taking the kids out on field trips and, just kind of seeing how they interact and mediating when they have, disagreements and whatnot. But mostly I want to be the, Save-A-Ho in the Captain Save-A-Ho situation. Like, oh my God, what the hell is that? I'm not paid enough for this shit. Somebody get me out of here. Oh, that was kind of cool. Are we going to the Marshmallow Dimension next? Like, what the hell? I think I would have a lot of fun.
So you're some sort of hypersexual Miss Frizzle.
I mean, you're not wrong, because I would be hitting up voodoo. I would be hitting up magic. I'd probably be hitting up Damien Hellstrom. I might even take a run at Scarlet Witch. So I'm just saying.
I like that you're like, I'd even take a run. I know her shit's a little too crazy for anybody right now.
It's literally dangerous to try.
Right, but that's what attracts me, is a little bit of danger. I'm like, I could end up in an eldritch forest, or I could be having a good time. Maybe both.
For me, I kind of think I'd want to be in like a position where I'm still a student, but mentoring the younger kids, kind of on my way to being offered a staffing position.
So you're like a TA meets RA. SA. Okay.
Yeah, that's
student of Pig Latin.
Like an RA. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sort of predictably Nico, so I would really want to work either in the music or the phys ed department, because I, you know, if you can't roll your eyes, you can't find me. So it just wouldn't work. Now,
yeah, she'd be the musical phys ed teacher.
Why not both?
Yeah, I'm really into, like, I'm just going to start lifting pianos all the time with magic while I play them. So my question then, new guys, what would you guys see yourselves doing? Would you guys be students? Would you guys be faculty? Would one of you want to be the Hagrid, right? Like, I just want to live in the forest and hit things with an umbrella. Like, you know, is that for you?
Absolutely, guest adjunct, because I will be visiting and helping out from the whatever mutant academy that I would actually be working at.
I think I'm a full-time tenured professor and I'm never leaving, but I'm bad at my job.
So,
most of them?
TK said realistic expectations and Steven said better people. Got it, got it, got it.
I mean, you know.
Now, before we can even get into the magic, the wonder, the spectro magic that was issues 13 and 14, which, Raven, I don't know how you called it so hard, but the volume of Marie Laveau between issues 13 and 14 was extraordinary. So super on the money there. But I just want to comment on Just as Strange as You being a super fulfilling story. Knowing Terry the way we do as a show and fans, it was great hearing him say that he's also a fan of Scotty and he really wanted his character to be able to interact with Strange Academy. And then months later, for him to actually get to do that was fulfilling. Like, as a fan and a friend, like, I was just over the fucking moon reading that. I also couldn't believe that, having had Scotty on several months earlier, Scotty basically said they're very protective of Strange Academy. You know, Raven, as part of that interview, I don't know if you remember, he said, we have designed this book so that it lifts out of continuity exactly. You shouldn't need to know what era this came out to enjoy it. So this was really incredible. They sort of let the editorial walls down and let a queer Latin man write the first entry in this series, not by the creators. And then, you know, as a proud Latin man, and knowing that, you know, Latin and magic, it's kind of really hard to take those two ideas apart in a lot of ways. Seeing so many Latin creators want to play in the Strange Academy sandbox was really, truly moving to me. And, you know, I don't know how many realize this, but I just really want to wake up one morning and be Robbie Reyes. So the amount of Robbie Reyes in this one shot, I just needed to get it out because, you know, he's my dream fiction suit. So, okay, anyway, Strange Academy is part of Marvel Voices community. Those of you who had a chance to look at it, how did you guys feel about seeing Strange Academy shed the confines of its own title and emerge into something much more powerful? The Marvel Universe at large's attempt to create representation for its readership.
I loved it so freaking much, because honestly, I think I got more Germaine in that short story than I've seen for like most of Strange Academy. And like, that's not a knock. That's no shade at all.
Agreed. But agreed 1,000%.
We actually got to get into a little bit of who Germaine is, his style of magic, you know, kind of what it's been to him, and the way he clicked so perfectly. Like, and it wasn't like, oh my god, she's a hot girl, I want to talk to her. It was like, oh hey, wow, you're early, and oh, okay. Like, they felt like they had a good place to connect, and it went so well, and I loved it. I just absolutely loved it so freaking much, because that is honestly the representation and the story that I've been desperate to get about Tremaine, because he seems like such an interesting character with even so little said about him. That was just, oh, I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I loved it so much.
I actually have you on record going back as far as, like, I think it's the coverage for Seven saying that.
Yeah.
Kyle, you know, one of the things you've said is that Strange Academy often feels like nothing else in the Marvel Universe feels quite like it. It's such a unique experience. How did it feel, it losing some of that hyper-exaggerated Humberto Ramos luster in favor of, in some cases, much more exaggerative art?
I thought that it worked incredibly well. It gave Jermaine a more life, I think, just because we got to see so much of him in this, and it allowed him to have some more personality that we don't really see in the main Strange Academy story. And I really loved the way that they interpreted Ava in this. I loved her new costume. I loved being able to see her use her own powers more than just what she was doing in Reptil. It was a really great way to kind of connect the two series together, I think.
The takeaway I had, especially for Strange as You, is I want Ava in the book. Now I want to see her all over the place. And I don't know that that's going to happen. And if it doesn't, that's totally fine. But what a great character. And I'm so excited for some kind of future for her, if not necessarily in Strange Academy, maybe even in the background there. But she's somebody I want to see a lot more of.
And, you know, let's not forget the nature of fan favorite characters overriding the sort of social consensus on what should define a hit. You know, if we're taking a look at the design of crafting a teen character, right, of crafting an outsider, telling me how queer and Latino someone is doesn't make me love them. Having them speak proper code makes me love them. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, not to play a time travel game, but, you know, Steven and I were reading New X-Men Academy X as it was coming out.
Yes.
And we had just read New Mutants Volume 2. And so I was super fucking obsessed with the New Mutants Volume 2. Like those kids in particular. I was obsessed with Wind Dancer, with Surge, with Prodigy. Like those were my kids.
Yes.
And I thought the Hellions were fine, I guess. They were
hey,
fine. Like they were so over the top.
They were my kids.
Such but that's even what I'm saying. Like, they were your kids. And they were treated so secondary and so background. But
I know.
But now who's still around? Like Rock Slide was a major part of Ten of Swords. I mean, yeah, now he's sort of swag, but you know, it's
agree.
He's like a pebble slide now.
Yeah, he's a couple of grains of sand short of a beach, and it's a tough day. But you know, the other side of it is Annalie, who went from random green background character to gay bartender icon, I guess.
Yeah.
I have this whole thing where he and Blob need to have this very father-son relationship where Blob is like, I know I'm not gay and I know I'm not strange looking the way you are, but no one's ever taken me seriously either. And if you're going to work for me, you're also going to get your life together. And like, I want to write this so bad. And I just really want to cast Mike O'Malley as Blob. Anyway, so
I just want to say really quick that I would really love to read that, actually.
Right?
Yeah, I'm into this now.
Anyway, I have so many feels. But, you know, the kids that survived are Annalie, are Pixie, are Mercury,
yeah.
Rockslide, not Sophia, who, yes, I mean, don't get me wrong, X-Factor was the greatest thing ever. And anyway, so characters like Ava become popular over time, I guess. I don't know. So many feels. I am so sorry. This
I
book
hope
is
to see fun. Her in there. I think.
Oh, my God. Yes.
She's yeah. a great character. She's a great. I mean, like, it's crazy now because there's so many kids at the school already that are just my favorite. So I, on the one hand, I'm like, they can't possibly add another one. And on the other, I'm like, just go for it. Keep adding them. Make me love them all.
I know. It's really, I can't like figure out who my favorite actually is.
I've given up on trying to have a favorite.
It's just so difficult.
Doyle.
Right. Okay. God, I love Doyle.
I love Doyle.
Doyle. If he's sassy and his head catches on fire, I want to cosplay him.
I just love when his flame turns pink.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah exactly.
Oh my gosh.
It's so cute.
And he's always got the purple craggy arms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's also, as I was doing my read through this week, I've been screen capping things that I love, and there's just this, I forget what issue it's in, but I've got it in my photos now, this panel of him and Calvin fist bumping.
Oh, and yeah. They're
just the sweetest boys.
Mm-hmm. I love them
so much.
So I think that leaves us nowhere to go but into the actual issues 13 and 14 themselves, because I can't possibly schedule another recording for 13 and not talk about it. Nathan will kill me. Everybody's got a boss on this show, and mine is Nathan.
I absolutely love issue 13, and I was so excited to get Zoe's story. Mm-hmm. I love Zoe so much.
Now, I do want to say I have a lot of personal reaction to an all-male creative team telling this story. It is a specific concern. Mm-hmm. I'm thrilled, over the moon, delighted, and I'm just dick-fucked with happiness that this handled everything it handled with such a delicate vulnerability and such a sentimentally adult aplomb. It was so perfectly handled. But the optics on a lack of a woman and the lack of, as far as I am personally aware, a black voice contributing to this series does leave me at a bit of a loss. Now, don't get me wrong, Humberto Ramos is clearly a man of color, and I don't know you could ask for a better ally than Scotty Young. The dude is just like, I mean, if you tried to write the dream ally, who's also kind of a handsome dude, you would come up with Scotty Young, right? So I'm thrilled about that. But Raven, it is so important that when these conversations come up, they are immediately applied to the people this is meant to represent. From your perspective as a woman of color, how did these two issues and their handling of this sort of complex narrative of Zoe and her connection to real life woman Marie Laveau, how did that play out for you?
Honestly, I appreciate Scotty Young on a lot of levels because you can tell that he really does take his team to do a lot of research on what they're doing and what they're going through and how this would affect character. And so to see that not only, you know, she's from a family that had very competent magical masters in it, and she just, you know, she wasn't quite getting the hang of it, and, you know, she was struggling just to do even just the minor stuff. And she goes down a dark road, and the only possible way to rectify this horrible, horrible happening is to invoke, or at least try to invoke, one of the most powerfully recognized practitioners of magic, especially a closed practice ancestral magic such as voodoo. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they did it well. I think they did a lot of it very, very right. And they didn't fall into a lot of the tropes that other people who are like trying to show off, oh yeah, we know about voodoo, let's do a goat sacrifice. I'm like, okay, no, that does not need to happen every time. That's not how voodoo works. And, you know, a lot of times they forget the ancestral.
I mean, you run out of goats,
right? Well, and goats are not always voodoo. Sometimes that is more Santeria, right? And sometimes you see a lot more like Santeria-esque iconography and whatnot. And this, it had much more of the connection to voodoo that I've seen, especially in how familial and community-based it is. It's very much a thing that has to be in your family line. That's really the only way to get into these particular religious practices is if you are part of a familial line, and her family is. So I like the fact that they made that very prominent, that, hey, this is part of our family. This has been going on for generations and generations. So they literally invoked their ancestor, please, for the love of God, help our daughter. She went down a dark path and it cost her everything. You know, you may not be able to bring her directly back to life, but is there anything else you can do? And so, yeah, just the whole going to her grave and making the mark and making that wish and understanding that the ramifications were not that, oh yeah, we're going to get back a perfectly healthy living daughter. We're taking a chance as to what kind of resurrection this is going to be. I'm like, I loved that so much. And I also love the fact that her family didn't seem to treat her differently after that. She was still their kid. And, you know, the minor magics that they did for her so that she could appear human and still function in human society is great. But it's not, you know, I don't think we've ever seen them like be abusive towards her or, you know, oh God, how could you do this? You know, just, you know, you're the whole reason that this is happening. Da, da, da. We've never seen the abuse part of it. We've seen somebody who screwed up, recognized that they screwed up, took responsibility for that, and her family is still very supportive of her. And that makes me so happy.
You know, it has a lot of elements that remind me of Epiphany Greaves Constantine from the Pete Milligan run of Hellblazer. But instead of having like a psychotic mafioso magic nut job dad, her family doesn't suck. And I really appreciate that. I would love to know, as some of you just like hardcore binged this book this week, and some of you, this book has been sitting inside of you for, you know, the better part of a year and a half. How did all of the Zoe stuff play out, seeing this incredibly strong character's backstory come into focus?
I was actually really happy I didn't have to wait that long. I really, really excited when I saw her on the cover of the next book, the previous issue, and I really, really did love her story. I just love her so much. I can't explain it. I just do.
You know, I was starting to feel like we might not get it for a while. And the thing that I was focused on, kind of like Raven said, but not her family, her friends love her so much. Yeah. This isn't a book that has decided to do tortured teen getting bullied, like Watch the Misery, which is oftentimes not kids' experience. You know, oftentimes kids that are having a lot of trouble in life or have a stumbling block have good friends around them and have people who love them and accept them for who they are. And to find a way to depict conflict, even conflict among friends, and not resort to tropes of just like abject bullying misery has been fantastic in this whole book. And so it had sort of made me background actually ever getting the information. So it wound up almost being surprising when I came to this issue and I was like, oh, we're going to find out today.
And you know what? I just need to say thank you for that perspective, because of all of the reasons you could have made fun of Donna Martin, you're telling me it was her fucking dyslexia you went after? You're trying to tell. Okay. Now, Kyle, Zoe's story is a bit darker than the narratives you tend toward. But I wonder if the amount of heart tempered that for you.
Definitely. I mean, we've spent 12 issues up to this point seeing Zoe struggle with her existence and seeing Desi kind of helping her to become more accepting of herself, which from a despair demon is kind of amazing.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
This issue where she finally explains to the class what she went through to get to where she is today, that is a huge step for her. And it really made me love her that much more because it showed a growth in her that shows the kind of strength that this community that she has become a part of has given her. It's just wonderful to see. That dark past is no longer overshadowing her as a character. She's surpassing that at this point for me.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And speaking of dark pasts, I don't mean to love villains so much, but and not like villain culture, right? Not like I'm like Joker, yeah. I'm like, no, you can burn Joker to the ground. I don't give a shit. But like, I love villain design, and I kind of feel like if you look at Imperator and you don't go, nope, that's Chris Bacalo right there. Don't know that we speak the same comic language.
Okay. Now, yes, he looks just like, what's the Child of the Vault's name?
I forget his name, but yes, he does look just like him.
The Hydrokinetic. He looks exactly like him to me.
Yeah, I noticed that too when he first showed up in Bacalo's run. I noticed that too.
I was such a big fan. I mean, Jason Aaron is sort of like far and away my favorite comic book writer. And, you know, well, I'm Pete Milligan, but, you know, Pete Milligan only deigns us with work every so often because he's Pete Milligan, and he has become more of like, at some point he just became this ephemeral cloud being. And I think it was right after he had Mama, Did You Sleep With My Boyfriend be an actual line of dialogue in an X-Men comic, and nobody got that it was a soap opera parody. Anyway, I can't keep defending that run. Literally.
You really can't, Nico.
No, I can, and I will, but I can't on air. So I think that run of Doctor Strange is really great. I think it's really cool that Scotty Young loves to touch on stuff he loves. I'm willing to hazard that not a lot of people have read the run this character comes from, but without being reductive of a run I am very positive on, I do kind of think you got everything you needed from that flashback page. It was a little bit 1970s. It was a little bit like, you know, Stanley's shorthand. Thanks, Jack Kirby, for doing all the work. Yeah. But I thought it worked. For those of you who have read it and those of you who haven't, how do you feel about Imperator? Are you guys as into him as I am, or do you guys have bad taste?
I'm 100% into him. I will say... Wow.
I was being an ass. Like, silly. No, like, actually, everybody has great taste. I love all of you.
This surprised me in such a pleasant way, because I was not necessarily into the idea of Imperator coming back and taking up a ton of page time and it becoming a whole new Imperator plot. And so the flashback works because it doesn't really matter who Imperator was. The point is he needs this thing which is established, and Emily gets it for him. And the point is about wish fulfillment. I was gearing up for like, here comes the giant Imperator storyline that's going to take over this book. And instead we just got this really beautiful moment.
Yeah. I was really hoping we weren't going to go into this whole, she releases this like crazy villain onto the entire Academy, and then we are spending issues on dealing with that. Exactly. I really like that she opened it, talked to him, and resolved it in that same issue. It made me feel really happy, and it made me love Emily so much more.
Oh my god, yes.
Yep.
Like, yeah. I adore her.
When, and honestly, to me, his rage, his anger was very understandable.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But also his imprisonment was also very understandable. So I was like, I've seen so many, you know, young children, I'm just trying to help, and yeah, they let out the big bad and everything right. goes sideways, and I was like, oh, please don't do this, please don't be this dumb. For her to do the one thing that not only showed empathy but also understanding,
yeah,
she gave him something that he desperately needed, that so needed to happen, because he was basically in solitary confinement for how long now, and was going to continue to be there for, you know, however long. So, you know, solitary confinement can drive a person absolutely mad. And when they get out, they are so much worse for it. She gave him just a little something to keep him sane, to keep him happy, and to make his existence, you know, at least livable. So she worked on the rehabilitation of a prisoner versus the punishment of a prisoner. And that was just beautiful to see.
Yeah, she gives the Imperator hope. And that's something that I don't think Doctor Strange could ever give to him. Mm-hmm. And that's why I like Emily, because she doesn't just go for the answer that Strange tells her. She finds her own path using the knowledge that he provides, and she reinterprets it. And it's not just hope for the Imperator, it's hope for the future, for pretty much everybody involved in Strange Academy, I think.
The other thing I want to say is, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but there are a lot of times where Ramos's style reminds me a lot of Bocciolo's.
Oh, yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah, it was the Flash run at the same time as Gen X.
Right. Mm-hmm. There are times when he will draw a character so differently, and Imperator is that character for me. It is definitely a Bocciolo design, and it would be really easy for Ramos to draw him very similar to how Bocciolo does, but he really puts his own style on the character, and I love it.
Now, speaking of characters getting new designs, issue 14 does something.
Yeah.
I'm so excited.
I don't want to get I don't want to get hit with a stick or anything. I love a lot about issue 14. I think Gaslamp was designed just for my taste level as to what a villain should look like. He looks like an 1800s gaslight version of M-Plate, and that gets me hard in places I didn't realize could get erect.
Nico, and that is so what I like. Okay, so with Poppet, all I kept thinking of DOA and M-Plate. Yes. The whole time.
1000%. And that's, you know, I really love a lot of things about this issue. I swear to God, I really don't like inexplicable future wars between friends. It's just not my trope. But it did give us my precious Doyle looking like Iron Mamu. And I'm super duper Doyle addicted to Iron Mamu suit.
I bet she'd like to be Doyle addicted.
I want to cosplay it. I just damn well want to cosplay it, first of all.
It was giving me Holocaust from Age of Apocalypse.
I got Holocaust as well. Yeah.
Not a bad way, but I was not, I did not get Iron Man. Although now that I'm looking at it, I see it perfectly.
I was just very heartbroken that apparently Desi and Zoe break up. Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
And now we have to tell the difference between Alvy and Eric.
Eric. Okay, I guess there is a character that I'm not the most in like enamored with, but I do love Alvy.
Mm-hmm. But the thing about Eric is you're hating him and wanting him to be better is one of the conflicts that this book is make that I like, because he's not like a, you know, there's hope for him. You know that if he can hang out with these kids and get his shit rocked a little bit, he'll snap out of it.
Absolutely. I do want him to succeed. I mean, his lineage, he is the child of one of the greatest, yeah, you know, people ever in the history of Marvel. And I just want him to be, you know, better, like you said. But I just, I need
he's a little
to see
shit. He's absolutely need, yeah, a little shit.
I just need to see it from him. And I just love Alvy, so I get my fill for him from him anyway.
Doyle's Quentin Quire, but his head's on fire.
Oh, please don't do that.
Sometimes Quentin's head's on fire when he's real phoenixed up.
They had a dark Shaley and a dark Gus. Yeah. I was like, what actually like surprised me was freaking Calvin. Like,
Daddy Calvin.
I was all about Daddy Calvin.
Right? I'm like,
Lord Almighty.
Damn. I'm okay with a lot of this. Like,
did anybody else get the impression that it was maybe Emily's side that were the bad guys?
Yes, actually, that is exactly what I was thinking.
Okay.
Possibly.
Mostly, I don't know why, but for some reason, Gus and Alvy being on the opposing side and Shaley actually are what did that for me.
And honestly, despair.
Okay, so I wasn't 100% certain about her because, you know, she could have leaned into her whole, you know, demon side, but I do think she's like such a genuinely, like, I don't know, good person. Demon, love her. She just wants to help people.
I don't love the Calvins of books. I don't like feeling bad for people. That like I mean, like, I love empathy and sympathy, but like I don't love sad sack characters.
Okay,
that's not my thing. And I kind of want to be like, shut up, you piss baby, and kick him a little bit right now. And I need a reason not to lay my boot down.
I'm kind of with you.
I mean, you're all wrong, but that's fine.
I have to say, like, his storyline, I feel like it's almost taking away from Zoe's in a way and, like, making it about him. And I also feel like, honestly, like, he was given away to try and catch up, and he's barely tried. And it just feels like he's bringing this on himself.
Yeah, this is, I agree with all that. I loved when he was presented with, like, okay, maybe you can't do all the magic, but, like, you're a part of this world now. Fucking get into it.
Yeah.
And so, but again, this is another conflict that I'm like, there, it obviously has to be there. So this to me is a good one. And he's another character that I'm like, I want to see you get your shit rocked so you learn your lesson.
Right.
And B, I want to see you then be the best goddamn librarian they've ever had.
Right. And I'm really hoping that this actually means that Zoe is going to play like an integral part in the resolution of this storyline. So I am here for it in that sense.
I'm looking for Zelda on the Magicians.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, he needs to start having those swoopy hand gestures all the time.
Swoopy hand gestures.
See, now for me, Calvin is a very understandable character, but I can understand why people read him wrong, because a lot of people have not been through the adoption system.
Right, that's
very true. And they've never had to be part of the dog and pony show. I have a unique perspective because I was adopted, as was my younger sibling and their current spouse. And the adoption system is a dog and pony show where you get brought out, and if you're the best, you get taken home, hopefully, and maybe not returned. Like, there's so much bullshit that goes through that particular process. So I understand why his view of what his worth is. Like, if I don't have magic, what is my worth? If I have no worth, I can be taken back. I can be thrown away. I'm expendable. So I can understand where he's coming from, and I know that he's got to go through a lot of dark shit and a lot of honestly personal therapy to resolve issues that come with his identity. So I can understand why people are mad at him, but I can also understand what the fuck he's going through, because
no, that's an incredible perspective.
That was such a great perspective, and it actually it completely
changes everything for me.
Yeah, same.
Yay.
I did not at all think of that at that perspective at all, and
honestly, it changes the writing for me too. Like now. I'm like incredibly impressed, because I'm literally paging through it now and I completely see it.
Yeah, they actually like did kind of touch upon that a little bit, like in the writing. So I'm amazed that I didn't catch on to that. I feel very sorry. I feel awful.
I'm gonna be honest with you guys. I've been on the episodes with Raven before, so we've discussed, you know, this sort of thing. I am not by any means passing judgment on people.
No.
By any stretch. People are real and have feelings and can hear me. And people are great. But, you know, when a fictional character is like, you know, without my magic, some nothing, I'm gonna go meet a dark magic nighttime street lamplight vendor. I don't know. You know, we get to kind of poke. Now, Kyle, Kyle, you're a Calvin guy.
I am.
So talk me through what this was like for you. Was this like, Calvin, no, don't. Why, Calvin? Or were you like, no, go do it. Gaslight or whatever.
Gaslamp. So
I'm dead.
Gaslamp. Okay, fine. Okay.
I mean, in fairness, his name is 1000% a reference to Gaslight.
Yeah. I love my sweet boy so much, but I understand that this is the path that his story needs to take. I hate seeing it because I don't want him to suffer, but I know that he has to hit rock bottom before he can start getting better. And understanding his worth to himself, to his friends, to his world, I wish that there were a better way for him to do that, but I think he needs to understand the consequences of taking the shortcut, which is something that, to be honest, strange, the Academy is avoiding entirely to begin with. We explored earlier in the season, they completely are circumventing the cost of magic here. So he needs to understand that there are consequences. I hope that it doesn't lead to significant damage. But at the same time, him taking this path and the weird look that Emily had at the end of issue 13 are what kind of made me think that, yeah, they're the bad guys in the future.
And honestly, you can hate a character's actions, especially when you know it's going to lead to ruin, but still love the character.
Oh my gosh, yes. You should 1000%. You should always be able to scrutinize things that your fave does. I mean, my fave is Emma, so.
She's never done anything wrong.
Never, ever in the history of comics, ever.
And okay. Maybe because she has so much skin. Now, it's unbelievable to me because Strange Academy is actually the book that we expanded the purview of the show to include, right? It's where we got in the whole magic for mutants, magic, and Marvels. Mm-hmm. And it seems like every episode we go incredibly long. And it's usually because somebody new is coming in to talk about the book for the first time, right? So we've had Dante join up. We've had Jonah join in. Now we've brought in a whole slew of newbies, right? And I love how emotional and reactive this book makes people because it's the kind of thing where this book is designed to get that sort of ad hominem reaction. It's not going for big thought. Not that the book isn't smart and clever and layered and nuanced, because it is, but that's sort of like the second read reaction, right? It's going for the big emotional shock, which is why I think things like the last page and its delectability go so easily unnoticed. But on the last page, we actually have a time travel advisory. And in the age of the pando, we actually have travel advisories all up and down our dicks. So I feel like this is super clever. And the layers of clever, 2099, Days of Future Past, 1602, Zombies, Age of Apocalypse, House of M, I can't even. Oh my god,
considering, that's hilarious.
Considering Nathan and Mai's upcoming Multiversity University, where we will tour everybody through all of the crossovers between the big two ever, starting in January, only on the Hubs Plus YouTube channel. So fucking get with it. I can't even. Ultimate Noir, Wastelands, and the Larval Earth. Every part of me is electric right now, and I have to know what all of you think.
I think it's okay. A, that travel page was just hilarious. Okay.
Oh my god, so funny.
I cackled so hard at this. But I also like the fact that it sort of recognizes that these are all possible timelines. So what Doyle saw was a possible timeline, not necessarily their timeline. So I love it, and I love that they are a little bit fourth walling it when they're going, yeah, don't go to these places, you know, all these places that we've actually done here in the Marvel Universe.
I kind of wish that I knew most of these. It kind of fell flat for me. I understood that, yeah, these are other storylines, but without having read any of them, I'm like, why would we be avoiding them?
I just want to say, as Strange Academy's newest tenured professor that is really bad at his job, I'm going to 2099 anyway.
La Lunatica. Theater of
Pain. As your guest adjunct, I approve the mutant students attending Days of Future Past.
They need that lesson.
They need that lesson. But not House of M. None of us need to revisit House of M.
No. No, we just pretend like that timeline never happened.
I would visit 1602 because that was written by Neil Gaiman, and I would use Neil Gaiman multiversity rules to segue my ass over into Sandman. And from Sandman, I'd hop John Constantine's trench coat all the way over to Animal Man, where I would use his multiversity abilities to transport myself through dimensions. And I would be able to go to all those other worlds that way anyway. I know I basically just decided I was going to like tick my way through alternate universes, but it's a plan.
I'm impressed with the detail of the plan. I mean,
can't stop me. Too late.
Oh my goodness. I can't wait till issue 15.
Me too.
Yep. Oh my god. Yeah, I'm obsessed now.
Yeah, no, seriously. I'm really excited to see what Captain Kerosene has in mind for our amazing students.
I am absolutely obsessed with Poppet, and like I desperately want a little Poppet so bad.
Right. Like I definitely want to see like who is in the cavalcade of creepy characters with Gaslamp, because I really want to make that jacket now.
Maybe they can start their own school with evil kids.
Ooh, that'd be fun. Oh, but then it's gonna be sad when we have defectors.
Well, and I feel like unreasonable, but I feel one of the things that this book is missing out on is franchising. Not that I necessarily think that Strange Academy has the financial status, like its sales numbers every month, warrant a spinoff, but I feel as though with a very different creative team, you could have a very viable spinoff. Like, no one would have guessed that the best-selling X-Men title of 2021 was going to be Demon Days. So who could exactly say if they did a sort of X-Men-Z-er Strange Academy book with your Amanda Seftons, your Ilianas, your, you know, your Wandas.
Such a good idea. Truly. The fact that they did actually mention mutant students means that there is potential for that in this universe.
I just don't think you want to try and do that within like the first year, year and a half. I think you need 2 years worth of establishment. Then you do the spinoff, because then you have very solidly built characters.
But I want it now.
I know.
Give Raven and I a few more months to get the pitch together, okay? Right?
Yes. Okay. Right? I accept.
I'll say this is also why I would love a Krakoan school book, because I would love for these two schools to collaborate and also have a sports
league. I feel like that's something that never really happened for the X-Men, is that whenever there was a school book in the greater Marvel universe, they never really did anything with the X version of that. So I would love there to actually be like something coinciding. So
and I would need it to be the Secret Wars Bowl.
The Secret Wars Bowl.
Exactly.
Hey everybody, Nico here again, and I love this Darkhold event. You know, if for no other reason, it sort of explores kind of the deep character ideas that we love about a number of these characters. I thought that the Black Bolt issue that we covered in this segment was absolutely at the top of my 2021. And I think especially for an event that no one's really sure what they're looking for, it kind of plays out like a what if, but it's got elements of the Darkhold. So things from the WandaVision series. So people are expecting Scarlet Witch and they're getting Spider-Man with too much skin. And it's just, it's been an event. But as long as everybody's getting something really awesome out of it, the way I got that Black Bolt story, I really think this is an event that is going to be remembered pretty well. As always, guys, we love making this show for you 3 times a week, every week. Mondays covering Magic, Wednesdays covering X-Men, and Fridays covering General Marvel fanfare. So until we return to cover the great halls of Krakoa, keep those mutant lights lit, those Krakoan gateways open, stay out of the Darkhold, and we'll see you on the other side.
Welcome back to another exciting segment of X's for Podcasts, where we talk about Marvel's mutants and magic week after week. I'm Nathan. You can find me online at Twitter at DazzlerAOA. That's DazzlerAOA on Twitter.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nico, and you can find me staring into the books of madness, because evidently that's the plot of this. On Twitter and Instagram at NicoAction. That's NicoAction.
And that, as usual, makes me Kevo, and you can find me over on the socials at Kevo Really, KevoReally, not really getting most of this title.
And I'm Jonah, and you can follow me over on Twitter and Instagram at PeakJonah, that's PEAK, and we hope you survive this experience, unlike Hank, unlike Reed Richards, and unlike the is he not Black Bolt.
Unlike my patience.
And I guess that means we are covering the Darkhold Wasp, the Darkhold Black Bolt, and the Darkhold Spider-Man. So, just real quick, the credits for these issues. Darkhold Wasp, written and color artist, Jordy Blair. The artist is Claire Rowe. VC's Clayton Cowles is our letterer. We have on Darkhold Black Bolt, Mark Russell is our writer. Our penciler is David Cutler. Roberto Poggi is our inker, and Matt Miller is our colorist. And on Darkhold Spider-Man, we have Alex Pagnadel is our writer. Dio Neves is our artist. Jim Charlampides is our color artist, and VC's Clayton Cowles is our letterer. And if I said any of those names wrong, please reach out to me on Twitter at DazzlerAOA and let me know, because I hate to say your name wrong and I don't want to do that. Like, first off, overall on this event, Jonah, was it you that pointed out to me where it really lets us know what's going on here?
Yes. So if you have been following our coverage, the previous episodes that have been covering Darkhold Iron Man as well as Darkhold Blade, we talked about how these stories don't give enough context as to what exactly they're meant to be doing. However, I went back and read a couple of these issues while I was waiting for a plane, and I was like, I got time. So I'm reading these, I'm going through everything. So I'm going through it, and on each of their individual credits pages, there's a blurb at the very top of the page that talks about each character's backstory, where the character comes from, and then all of them have the line, but then K'thon showed them the path that turned them mad. So all of these stories are meant to be the visions these characters are seeing in alternate timelines or alternate situations that would have turned them mad. And I would love to pose to everybody here, with this knowledge that this is what these stories are meant to be, does this change your opinion of any of the stories previously covered, or does this change your opinion of how you view what we are going to be covering today?
Well, I mean, if I were forced to read my own life not scarring me over and over again, I'd go nuts, because I actually think one of the things that then that makes really significant is almost all of these are about someone these people love going crazy. For Tony, it's that he would drive Pepper crazy. For Black Bolt, it's that ultimately being Black Bolt drove Maximus crazy. For Iron Man, it's Pepper. You know, did I say that one first? I meant for Hank, it's Wasp. You know, there's a lot of my over-devotion to my superheroics could be the thing that drives the people I love crazy. And in that regard, I almost resent the nomenclature. You know, we just had this fucking problem when we covered Trial of Magneto, or as I like to call it, Tom the Fifth. And, you know, as we were talking about Tom, one of the things we kept coming to was the nomenclature was garbage. And I think it would have been a lot more powerful if perhaps it was like Darkhold, the Iron World, Darkhold, Spider-Verse, Darkhold, the world of Wasp and Ant-Man. Because like, it's so much more than just that one person. And I think that is a transformative element.
You know, with all that perspective, it kind of just feels like this is a really spooky version of Marvel's What If?
Yeah, I kind of feel that, totally.
And knowing that this probably is not going to do very much to have any super hardcore immediate ramifications on the Marvel Universe based on its placement, on its delays, and the things that have come out around it, you know, it's... I guess the perspective that if you were paying attention to the summaries, it is a little bit more obvious that this was just what ifs all along. I guess it's less frustrating to know for certain, but you know, again, then what is this leading to?
It's Darkhold Turtles all the way down,
I guess.
So to answer Jonah's question, like, I would really have wanted to see it really go more in line with the roles they were supposed to play. Like, if Iron Man's supposed to be the dreamer, like, and Blade the hunter, and Wasp the artist, Black Bolt the stoic, and Spider-Man the fool, like, what do the one-shots really have to do with that? Like, Wasp as the artist has nothing to do with Wasp Darkhold. I mean, it's a great tale. I like the story, but it really doesn't have anything to do with it.
Wait, was Peter the fool?
Yes.
Did I miss that famous part of most jester performances or Punch and Judy shows where the point of humor is adhesion? Because otherwise, I don't know that I don't know. Ha ha, funny adhesive joke. I don't understand then.
You're God rubber, I'm glue. It. Wait, no, I'm rubber, yes. You're glue, and you're going to stick it.
Why did we do any of this?
Yeah, that's exactly, that's like, it doesn't make any sense.
I really appreciate you pointing that out too, because I'd completely forgotten that segment, that it was that they did one of those, everyone gets a superlative, and for it ultimately not to have anything to do with any of their titles. Yeah, that's really, really flippin' weird. Huh.
I more so think the titles were kind of more Wanda's magic upon calling people, and they fit those titles. I don't know if it had anything to do with their becoming mad by reading the Book of K'thon. I get what people are saying, and it definitely would have been nice to have more of that kind of cohesion, but I don't know if I can agree with the separation takes away too much if these specific stories are meant to be specifically their visions while they're reading, and they're reading too much and become mad and become agents of K'thon.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Is it like K'thon, or is it like T'thon? Kazan? Or is it like... Because no, I just like... yeah, I always thought it was like bug noise on. Like, I always thought in order to say his name right, you had to rub your legs together really fast.
I just assumed that it was a lazy call to Cthulhu.
It was the 60s. Yeah. They were banking on the fact that nobody was well-read.
well, yes, but also in Lovecraftian horror and that Eldritch horror kind of things, we're not meant to... Technically, we're not supposed to be able to pronounce their names properly. So however we say it is technically right.
I like that.
Danny Snakeface.
That's correct.
It's just so hard to see this when you compare it with, say, Defenders, right? The tarot card that Doctor Strange pulled for each Defender is really wrapping up with their story.
Well, and that's the thing. It's Chekhov's list of superlatives. You don't really tend to employ that sort of writing trope unless it is going to go somewhere and feed into the story somehow. Otherwise, some of those superlatives aren't necessarily what we would immediately think of for those characters anyway. So why are you using them? It just feels really random, and it you know, there's supposed to be a purpose to the things that you're placing in your fiction. It's just really random then.
Hopefully it will all be revealed in the Omega issue.
And I really love, Nathan, that you brought up the beautiful tarot symbolism in the pages of Al Ewing and Javier Rodriguez's brilliant Defenders, because it's sort of something that I say about horror a lot that I feel like a lot of people don't necessarily always think about in the same way. I think there is a lot of room in the world for the scary that is Hannibal Lecter, and that's kind of Defenders. It makes you think, it makes you look at yourself, it makes you consider your place in the world. And then I also think there's a lot of room for Freddy Krueger, who's a fucked up looking dude with a messed up glove who just wants to come for your kids. And like, there's no room in the world for him. Kill him. But I think this book is the Freddy Krueger of Defenders Hannibal Lecter when it comes to tarot card reading. I still think it deserves to have 7 films. It's just a very different alien.
So let's dive into the books, right? So let's start with, I think it was the one I was the most worried about and the one that I came away loving the most because I love the character the most. So what are y'all's thoughts on Darkhold Wasp? So just for me to start, like, I was really afraid of this one because retelling that story of that period of Jan and Hank's divorce and the physical abuse he put her through is really a scary idea. I don't think that she really got her justice in this, because I don't think, even though the end came out and, you know, when she came out on top, so to speak, but the idea of Kang being the one to help manipulate her to this end is kind of disturbing to me. But what did you guys think overall of this?
So I didn't necessarily have the same affection for this issue, and I think it's sort of fascinating because I spent years not really understanding the Hank Pym hit Janet thing because I only had the books I had growing up, and there were references to Hank's rage, but you know, there's references to Logan's rage, and they fucking make references to Scott's rage, and like, so fuck, right? Now, ultimately, when I came to find out more about it and discovered that it was one, like, it was an accident, you know, each person added a layer to it and it transformed it from a hideous moment of raising his hand to his wife, which is equally unforgivable, to an insidious, unforgivable moment of, you know, striking his wife. And either one is wrong and just absolutely unforgivable. But what I do specifically feel then is this moment is not a moment we should really go back to unless we're going to commit to leaving Hank Pym in the past. And I just kind of want to put this out there. What does Hank Pym have that no one else has? What is so fucking amazing about this guy that no one else has? It can't be that he's the best Ant-Man, because he's not. It can't be that he's the only smart Pym, because he's not. It can't even be that he's the best bug-related size-changing original Avenger, because he's not. And all this issue made me realize isn't particularly anything about Wasp, because I feel like we have seen a lot of trips to this sort of storytelling mode before. It just made me think to myself, why didn't Hank Pym die in Secret Invasion and never come back?
Yeah, I get that. And I especially get the impulse to simply move on from the character if... you know, Michael Douglas's performance as Hank Pym, who doesn't have that same history that his comic book character has, is great. But I'm sure there are a lot of people who are clamoring for the fact that that was then erased from the character. And, you know, somebody overcoming abuse is then erased from the portrayal of these characters in media. It really is that you need to make a decision at a certain point. Is the character irredeemable because of this action? If you're going to keep revisiting it, then you really haven't moved on. So maybe that is what he needs to, I don't know, stand for, I guess, and be left as cautionary tale, I suppose, instead of someone we keep revisiting.
What both Kevo and Nico said made me realize, like, is this really the defining moment of Jan's life? Like, there's so much great stuff that she's done, and there's so many other points in her life you could revisit to revisit this one dark chapter of her life. Like, why are we doing it over, just like you guys said?
So I'm gonna do a compliment sandwich kind of style. So one, I think this is out of all of these issues and everything we've read so far, I jive so hard with this artistic style. Everything about the art for this issue works for me. The extreme heavy inking, the colors, the way that the lettering is done, like a lot of the panels of like the buzzing of the wasps, everything top to bottom, tens across the board. Literally all the artistic team for that in that regard, beautiful, great. I, like Nathan, was really nervous going into this issue. I was really coming into this with a lot of hesitation because I haven't really read a lot of that part of comics or that story for Janet and Hank, but I knew about it and I knew the significance of it, and it's a really touchy story that is there and it happened. And I really wish a different medium was done for Janet. I wish that it was just a different story. I don't want to disparage how the writer interpreted the prompt of write a story about Janet's past that would turn her mad. And I imagine that's what a lot of these prompts look like. And you can kind of just go wherever you want with it. I wish it was just a different story. I don't know if revisiting that part of her past and the end result is this is the vision she sees that turns her mad. I don't know if I really like that. I will say, though, the art is amazing again.
Same fucking bread.
It is.
Hold on, though. How many sandwiches do you have where it's two different kinds of bread?
But that's not what a compliment sandwich is.
I'm just saying, like, maybe it should be.
It's more like a compliment kebab.
I would rather have a compliment sandwich than a compliment plus getting skewered through the middle.
Okay, be a bitch. That works too.
I do agree, though. The art definitely helps redeem something.
But I think my biggest issue with this story overall is that it felt like a five-page story told across an entire comic issue. You kind of know immediately what is going to happen, or at least within a few pages. Like, I loved the choreography and direction on things like the panel where Janet is holding Hank's head, and it looks like she could snap his neck. Like, you really know that it's going to be coming, and then it does, and then that's it. And the issue was a little long for what feels like an inevitable payoff. I thought we were going to maybe see what came for Janet after, but instead, it just entirely, as Nathan pointed out, it reduces her entire story to this one thing, and it makes it mostly about Hank and her reactions to Hank, as opposed to making it her story.
I can think of one better story that would have been to see where she would have gotten driven mad, like probably something that emotionally resonates more with her than this would be the loss of Katie from that future reality that she had with Alex Summer. So, like, in Uncanny Avengers. So, if none of you guys read it, crazy, but Wasp and Havoc had a future baby, and they remember it, but the baby got stolen by Kang, of all people. So, there's just different stories you could tell with it. Now, there is one other, like, point I want to bring up, and I don't know if any of you guys caught this, or if you guys were really aware of this. This is the first real mention of a thread that was started in the Avengers The Crossing, of all places, where Kang is the one who manipulated Hank Pym into his darker actions, the same with what happened to Tony Stark as well. So this sort of takes that and picks it up and kind of re-mentions it. I really haven't seen that thread picked up since the 90s. And also, I don't like how it absolves the character of Hank Pym from his actions during that day. Like, it would, like, the same thing why some people were upset about the Dark Phoenix trial, absolving Jean of killing the broccoli people. What do you guys think about that?
Sure, I'll go. So I do think that one of the things that we have to be really careful of is something that Ariana, I almost said Ariana Grande, I have to. Something that Ariana Maher pointed out, which is, if you know a real human being who ate a planet, you're like, fuck, they're irredeemable. But if a comic character eats a planet, you're like... convince me they're not evil and it can be done.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why I want to see Hank Pym get kicked off the planet, because at this point we've really, really committed to Hank Pym committed a gross act of spousal abuse. And I love that we're adding the word spousal abuse because he did abuse his spouse, but let's really recontextualize that. A superhero randomly struck a friend. Just even take it down. Like, if Captain America was just like, I'm having a bad day. Hey, Bucky, come here real quick. We'd be like, what the fuck? So I really need us to kind of, you know, there is an element of the simple act of keeping Hank Pym around dangerously flirts with absolving him. And I think you're right that there is a lot of question of forgiveness and absolution and kind of a passing the buck involved in this Wasp story. But what I do want to say is, if I do have any feels about this Wasp story, I am very glad that a story about a woman being physically struck by her male partner was handled by so many female creators. I think that is a really necessary step. And I just really want to put out there that even if they were, you know, if anybody was trying to like split hairs, I would have been thrilled to see non-binary voices on this, not because a non-binary voice is the same as a female voice, but because I don't know that I've read non-binary voices dealing with spousal abuse. So the sheer act of any voice that was not a man's voice, the voice that crafted it and the voice that more frequently throughout the years has had the opportunity to return to the moment, I think is really an important step. I am at least glad if I feel particularly uncomfortable with elements of what occurred, they were handled by voices whose value far outstrips my own, if for no other reason, the scarcity of availability of their voice on this topic.
Yeah. So that brings us to the next story we're covering tonight, which is Darkhold Black Bolt, The Memory Trap. Like, I found this tale fascinating, but I don't know if I care enough about Black Bolt as a character to really find this as fascinating as it should, but I thought this was a really good like dive into Black Bolt relationship with Maximus. And are we reading Maximus or are we reading Black Bolt?
Ooh. Okay. So if I can, I would love to take this first. I am probably the person in this room who loved this issue the most because I think this issue hit the prompt the best. If the prompt is what is going to turn Black Bolt mad, I love this issue for that regard. Do I know a lot about Maximus and the kind of relationship that he has with Black Bolt? No, not really. But what I do know about Black Bolt is that above all else, he cares very much for his kind and his people, the Inhumans, as well as their safety and their continued growth and survival. And this issue, being from the perspective where Black Bolt doesn't even know if he can trust himself, nor if he knows his own thoughts are his own, where he is in this state of mind of complete confusion, as well as like this bated breath of, am I really Maximus or am I Black Bolt right now? And he's literally exiled from his entire community and world. I love this. I like truly think this was probably the best when it comes to what would turn these characters mad.
See, and here's what I have to say to that. I really agree with your assessment that it best follows the assignment. However, I feel this group participant least worked to match the other members of the group project because I don't feel that the tone and overall style and vibe match the much more horrific and frankly gory style and story of all of the other issues. I do agree with you, but I think that it stands out the most apart from everyone else's.
Now, let me challenge with a question here. And I mean, like, because this was probably my...
I dropped my tablet!
Okay, so this was probably my favorite issue of Darkhold so far by a large berth. Now, I perhaps thought the art on Blade was a little stronger, but I thought Black Bolt was probably the strongest issue. I also want to comment, Nathan, I am now obsessed with, and I'm going to only say his name the way you say it, Black Bolt, because I really like putting the emphasis on Bolt. not black, because he's mostly wearing like a blue these days. So,
right? Like,
so, all right. I loved this issue, and I question, whose fault is it? The great single that you can't get out of your head for being better than the rest of the songs on an average album? Or wow. The average album for letting you down, because this Black Bolt issue is at the top 10 of 2021 for me. I thought this was, because it was one of those things where I kept reading it and it kept being like, it was Lynchian, because I kind of kept being like, and now there's the Black Lodge, and now there's the woods, and the woods are outside of Twin Peaks.
And it's even a little ridiculously silly and over the top that like, you changed your physical body, erased your memories, and put in Black Bolt's memories. Like, that would be a thing that would be good for his plan, but that's not what it's about. It's about what would drive him mad.
He had the face-off surgery! And but, it made him crazy.
But it would make Black Bolt crazy if it exactly. was if he was led to believe that he thought he was Maximus, who thought he was Black Bolt. Like, that probably would drive me crazy if I couldn't.
Which
figure
is why
out
the campiness was. It doesn't really matter. The campiness isn't the point. It's that's what is going to drive him crazy, is not being sure, not knowing the right decision, but so desperate to make the right decision.
Trying to follow it got me. I went mad trying to understand what you were saying. It's Black Bolt thinking he's Maximus, dressed as Black Bolt with Maximus's chromosomes, but he's wearing Black Bolt's pajamas. He had Maximus's breakfast, though. So, like, there were layers to this. I genuinely thought this was one of the most exciting psychological issues I've read in a really long time. It reminds me why Marvel's failed attempt, like, because I do want to say, one of the things that this book definitely had as a series, Darkhold as a series, which I'm now calling Dankhold, it had a lot of failure on its plate to contend with. Because I know that Blade is having like the best time he has had since Wesley Snipes was first like, what tax problems? But here we are really seeing Blade, a guy who never seems to get his fair shake. And how many short-lived Iron Man successes have we had now? And the Inhumans failed how many times in a row? This reminds me why we keep giving the Inhumans a try. Because this could not have been an X-Men story. This could not have been an Avengers story. This was a Black Bolt and Maximus story. And anyone else, it would have been different. And anyone else, the, you know, conceits would have been a little bit different. But like, this was a Black Bolt story in a way that I was like, you know what? Sam Rockwell could have played. Like, there was, like, I could see it coming together so much that I could cast an actor in this issue.
You know what's really funny about that, though? I was going to ask, and then I was like, I'm not going to be an asshole. I'm going to look it up myself first before I say anything. I wasn't sure if Taros was a thing that existed before this or was something that was established. A Google search tells me no, but some of the first headlines that come up in response to this issue and that concept, there's a Screen Rant article where the headline is saying, Black Bolt Horror Story shows missed potential of Inhumans TV show. And it's really funny that you bring up the MCU and the filmability of these characters and these concepts, in that another review even pointed to the TV show. And how many years has it now been since the attempt at the Inhumans TV show? 6, 7? And Screen Rant went out of its way to reference that in response to this issue.
Yeah. I gotta say, it was the like probably the best written story I have read in a while. Like, just because I don't love the Inhumans and it didn't draw me in that way, I cannot deny the craft of it. And you're right, too. The story couldn't be told any other way than through the Inhumans.
And, you know, it's something that just came up with us over in a recording we just did for Happy Holidays, Mr. Howlett, which I know most of you are probably like, this is coming out after the holidays are over. And those of you who listened to that coverage would have listened to it. You know what I mean? Like, a holiday story gets a very specific vibe. And that's something we talked about a lot, because, you know, and there's nothing so holiday as Darkhold, right? So I'm glad I'm bringing it up here. But one of the things that Kevo said so beautifully in that story was that nobody could have started that story but Wolverine. Wolverine and Mystique. It's literally about two immortals talking about how lucky they are to have seen the last 200 years change in front of their eyes, which convinces them to continue doing random acts of charity that only they could understand. And so it's not just any two immortals, it's two specific immortals with specific frames of reference who have a specific past and a specific trajectory. Like, everything about that story was industry professionals at the top of their game crafting a narrative that could have only worked for those characters. And I will say, with the exception of the Spider-Man story, and to a much lesser extent, the Blade story, you know, because Jonah challenged me on this earlier, and I had said to him that I thought that the Iron Man story could have been anybody, but I guess not. I guess it could have been any inventor and his girl Friday, but even then the conceits would have been different. So I guess for everybody, Darkhold really is a character study, even if I don't like what the character study has to say, with the exception of Spider-Man, whose story was... Like, I love Alex Paknadel, but I don't know what happened there. For me, like, you know, like, he and I, not that it's a bad story, he and I usually just sync up a lot more, so I don't know what happened there, that our energies didn't, you know, I guess we had the wrong crystals in our pocket. But I did really think that the Black Bolt story highlighted an element of Marvel storytelling that DC also has. I'm not taking a knock against DC, and if you want any proof of it, Grant Morrison's original run on JLA and JSA with the idea of the JLA as Pantheon, right? That's the same kind of thing. But one of the things that Marvel Heroes offer in an abundance is an idea of a depth of world. Because we have so many writers and so many artists that have each added layers, Black Bolt doesn't speak. Most Black Bolt stories are defined by an absence of thought and speech. Here, there was so much thought, yet I still felt like I knew this character. I don't know. This issue is going to stick with me for a really long time. I'm going to be thinking about the way this issue made me feel for a really, really long time. And in that regard, I am grateful to everybody that worked on this project. Yep. I do stand by the idea that it is, you know, the standout track on a rough album, but it's a rough album by an artist I still really like, right? So even if it's not the album I need right now, I still am getting something from this, but Darkhold Black Bolt proved that, and I love the emphasis. It's so strong. It's got a resonant sound. It really does prove the point.
So, what's the consensus? Do you think it was Black Bolt, or do you think it was Maximus that we read the story about?
I have to believe that if the story were to continue, it would have to be revealed to be Maximus, because there, I don't know if their Black Bolt came to a logical conclusion as to why he couldn't fly, okay, outside of Maximus can't fly.
I think for me, the magic is we shouldn't know. It's that whole is Deckard a replicant thing, and I, you know, Deckard Shaw or Deckard Hobbs, whichever he is, I feel like I don't want to know, because not knowing is what drove Black Bolt mad. If Black Bolt found out the one thing he was sure of, himself, were not clear, that's what would drive him mad. So I'm going to go with who knows.
Ooh, and with that, I can actually see how this would tie into his role as the Stoic, actually. Like, this one, I think, Jonah, you said it right. This one really understood the assignment. Like, oh, okay. I'm getting more clues on that. Kevo, did you think it was Black Bolt or Maximus, or did you not care?
Oh, I don't think that it ultimately matters. That's the whole point. He doesn't know. And, you know, it's all theoretically a fabrication to drive them mad anyway. So technically it is him. Technically, then, at the end of the day, it has to be him, because it's all the thing that is driving Black Bolt himself mad.
And I absolutely agree with you, and that's my assessment on it as well. So that brings us to our last story and our trilogy of stories today, Darkhold Spider-Man, Tensile Strength. So this one seemed to me like more of a fun what-if tale than a real character story into Peter Parker for me. Like, the other ones actually seemed more like really in-depth character stories about what these characters would do in certain situations. And this one just seemed like a kind of like fun what-if story. What if Peter Parker got married to Gwen Stacy and some kind of weird unraveling happened? What was
fun? ? Question mark.
What did Gwen Stacy even have to do with this? Why was it even Gwen Stacy?
I don't know.
I would love to really get to know your version of a good time if you thought this was fun. So I am 50-50 on this issue. I think if we're thinking of things that would turn Peter mad, okay, putting him in a situation where he is to his limits and extremes because he was taught he has to use, he has the power, he has the responsibility. He's the only person who hasn't properly unraveled and he is at his breaking point of saving everybody. Okay, I get that. So that can really lead to something interesting. However, the unraveling, A, is weird.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure if I can follow. Like, some people looked like zombies, but they were still fully coherent. I don't really know exactly why we needed a Cronenberg version of Reed Richards. What I think Black Bolt and Iron Man got right is that it left on an ending that I think would still make the characters mad. Even Blade got that a little bit. I'm not exactly sure if this ended properly for what the story needed, because that's not like a maddening ending. That's just an ending to a story, if that makes sense. I feel like the more successful issues for me had an open-ended ending where you can still see the horror and the maddening. This just kind of ended.
I guess it's that losing Gwen to this drove him mad. I don't even know. But then that's even what I was talking about, where I wanted to see more from Jan after she went mad then. And we got this whole twist ending with Peter, which, you know, I don't get so much of this. I don't get why this is his story that would drive him mad. I don't get why Reed Richards factors so heavily into it, unless it's setting us up for the fact that Peter is probably going to be involved in the future film adaptation of Fantastic Four. I have to assume that's why John Watts is involved. But with this, you're setting up stuff like that? I know that they like to put seeds in Marvel Comics everywhere, but this one is so random. This whole story is so random.
Peter has a large history with the Fantastic Four, but I don't know if his bond really is with Reed, more so that he's best friends with Johnny Storm. And I don't know if there was maybe something there, if you're going to keep the same prompt, but their betrayal feels like a betrayal. It feels like, I know Reed Richards oftentimes can be a little bit of a hard ass or an idiot, but I feel like Reed would really would come up with a way that if he had to sacrifice himself, I'm kind of more led to believe that Reed would do that, as opposed to being like, go find me another stretchy person.
I have this really cool idea for Peter to turn Reed into a web. How can I reverse engineer that into this story?
There was this point where he was like, that was my finger. And I was like, oh, your finger? Gross. And then I thought about it. And I was like, hey, everybody, if you have not yet seen Spider-Man, don't do that thing. Go back where you came from. Oh, my goodness. Turn off the podcast. If you have not yet seen Spider-Man, no, go back where you came from. Don't do that thing. Turn off the podcast.
Then Spider-Man, turn off the podcast.
Right? Spider-Man, No Way Home for people who might not be getting it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Nathan, have you seen the movie?
Oh, yes, I have.
For clarity and quote-unquote legal reasons, we are talking specifically about Spider-Man No Way Home.
Yeah. Yes. Excellent. So I thought one of the most telling, purposeful, and it was exactly why you do a multiverse story parts of the entire film was my Spidey, who is Andrew Garfield, who I just like, I don't know, I really resonate with the sexuality of his Spider-Man, and Tommy Holly, cute boy Spidey, both being like, no, we're not making fun of you. We're actually, we don't have natural webbing. So we think yours is really cool. We're just interested. And, you know, classic Spidey being like,
well, yeah, it's I make it in my wrists and stuff. And it's my fluid, polo shirts.
And so I feel like if you really think about it, if Spidey's producing his web fluid, how is one of Mr. Fantastic's fingers weirder?
Mm. Yeah.
So like, I get that. So ultimately, this story even kind of hinges on how not unique Spider-Man's role is. And my whole issue with this story was it was the least all about Spider-Man. I don't think Spider-Man thinks of himself as the guy that has to knit the city back together. He might think of it as its protector, but I don't think he thinks of it as he's its damage control. And the X-Men are damage control. The X-Men aren't anybody's protectors. Like, the X-Men aren't like, let's stop this before it happens. The X-Men are like, oh no, something bad happened. Kill a bunch of people and hope you kill the right person. Spider-Man is a little bit more like, that guy's gonna throw a rock at that window. I am both going to web up the window and web down that dude. And this story was a lot about Peter behaving, number one, in ways that I don't necessarily love my Peter, and number two, not really feeling like my Peter. So, like, I don't know. This issue just didn't work for me. Alex Pacnadel is a brilliant writer, and the story beats were hyper proficient, executed with aplomb, and showed a sense of emotional intelligence that I look for from this quality and caliber of writer. But this really was one of those things where, like, you know, I love Tori Amos, but when the song Fat Slut comes on, I am like, skip this shit, okay? I love Alex Pacnadel, but Spider-Man Darkhold is his fat slut.
Okay, fair.
So a couple more things I was thinking about, because you brought up certain things. This Peter Parker doesn't create his own webbing, and he says to Reed, I get 3 hours of sleep on a good night. How much time does he have to make the webbing? Also, how does he have the materials?
Also occurred to me, yes.
Yep. I wondered feel that like, too.
Like, maybe instead of, maybe the more better prompt, if you want to go in line with the story, or I wouldn't say better, maybe a different prompt that might have resonated a little bit more with us would have been that Peter's running out of webbing and is looking for a solution, and that would turn him mad, the thought of having to, does he get rid of his friend, or does he, you know, uphold what he is taught that to save the world.
And it's sort of like what I said about the Black Bolt issue, where I found the whole conceit of Black Bolt, of Maximus turning himself into Black Bolt, a little bit silly, but I forgave it because of the nature of the story. I could forgive something silly like, how is Peter not running out of web, if I felt like the story was more on target with what this is supposed to be. But I don't understand why this is something that would that Peter would be compelled to do in the first place, to let it drive him to madness. So that's why I can't just suspend that, because it doesn't make sense for that to be something he's doing anyway.
Well, I guess my thought process and how I viewed it is that if Peter is the only person who hasn't unraveled, and Peter constantly has the words of Uncle Ben, with great power comes great responsibility, in his head, and that's the driving force for his character for a lot of things. I think that if Peter is in a situation where he's the only able-bodied person and the only person able to do anything about what's going on, I feel like he would put extreme himself in that way.
Now, for me, there were some parts that I did really like about this story. I did love the idea that the Venom symbiote would just die because he didn't want to bond with anybody else because Eddie Brock was dead. I found it confusing, but I did like that Doc Ock was one of Spider-Man's classic villains, but Doc Ock is one of the few people who's less affected by the unraveling. And the body horror of Reed Richards' un-goofification from the pile of goo was probably one of my favorite, like, body horror pieces that Marvel's put out recently, and they put out a lot.
Very well directed, yes. Very well choreographed, the movements and the shape of that character. I normally don't love gore, but I thought that it was very well styled and directed.
I agree. What did you guys have any favorite moments out of this issue along those lines?
Yeah, I did have a favorite moment in this issue, and it was the Venom moment, but for perhaps a different reason than, I don't know, I guess I just thought that the Venom moment showed that even Venom was trying to hold it together and Peter wasn't doing such a great job. Like, there was something really, even the villains are like, come on, Peter, that, like, I really appreciated. And I don't know, I just thought the issue, it had some really cool moments. The Venom thing was spectacular, and I did like the interpretation of Reed. I don't like a clean Reed. I like a damaged Reed. I like a Reed that's fallen to goop everywhere. So, and by that I mean he's really into Gwyneth Paltrow's brand. So,
those kegel eggs are killer.
Right? I like me a goopy Reed in a $3,000 white t-shirt.
Was there any point for Gwen Stacy to really be in the story, even though I guess it was just phone calls he was free playing?
It's just that could have been MJ. That could have been, I don't even know. Like, I don't know why it was Gwen.
Agreed.
Well, and you know what? I even think, like, it's... Okay, if you love Wolverine, you've got your fair share of love interests. You've got Mariko, you've got Jean, you've got Yukio, you've got Yuriko, you've got Sabretooth, you've got Maverick, you've got, you know, any Scott, you've got any number of people.
I'm sorry, wait, hold on though. Yukio is Storm's lover, sorry.
Go ahead. I'm pretty sure Yukio can love everyone.
Okay.
That's true. And now, if you love, you know, Daredevil, you can pick from any number of love interests as well that you want to write. I guess one of the magics of getting to write Spider-Man after waiting your whole life to write the Webhead is you kind of get to write your Webhead, the one you fell in love with. I would write him with Felicia, personally. I would save Gwen Stacy for with Norman because I like the JMS run too much. But I mean, you get your pick.
I got to say, I totally wish it was MJ too. So,
and I guess it's kind of ironic that if Gwen Stacy's death is that she was snapped by a thread and now she's kind of barely hanging on because of the thread. I don't know. There's a little bit of irony in there. Did I think the twist was good? Sure. But like, I agree. I'm not sure why Gwen Stacy, why not at a later point? Why was it this? Why would this be set so early on in Peter's life that Gwen Stacy is still alive? And then also
really made me throw my head back.
How does that connect to Peter being still good friends with the Fantastic Four at that point?
Sorry, I didn't mean to be such a crack up.
That's not my head back and forth. That's not my head back and forth.
And you know what? I get it. Jonah isn't falling for this story. And you know, it's one of those situations where I know I've been a little bit negative on this issue, but I certainly hope that Alex Paknagel doesn't feel like I was, you know, I felt fatal about this issue. Gwen Stacy jokes, Gwen Stacy jokes, goblin off a rooftop, Gwen Stacy jokes. I don't know what else to say.
Although I do have to say, if you were going to feature Gwen Stacy as the love interest, the Green Goblin should have been the main Spider-Man villain that shows up.
You know, it wasn't my favorite. I don't think it was a bad issue. Like, if somebody read this, I wouldn't be like, sorry about it. I would just be like, cool, not my thing, but everybody gets to play at their own frequency.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say the same kind of line, like along the same kind of lines, it wasn't my favorite. There were some cool story elements in it, but I didn't think it understood the assignment for as well as maybe Black Bolt or Blade. And then just one final question, because this is the end of the one shot. So I know some of you guys have already said it, but what was your guys' favorite one shot so far? I'd have to say between, I guess it made me change my mind on the Black Bolt one. Like I really come around on it. So I'd have to say between the Blade one and Black Bolt and just Wasp, because I love Wasp.
Blade and Black Bolt for me, a real blah situation. And you know, that opening one shot was just so fucking wacky. So opening Black Bolt. Blade. So
Kevo, did you have a favorite?
I don't think I'm ready to pick yet. Gonna wait until we get the last one and see how I feel about it all wrapping up, and then see how I feel about the middle issues.
That's very fair. And then Jonah, did you have a favorite? Or are you wanting to reserve judgment as well?
Black Bolt. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Black Bolt.